From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The perfect victim is a white male professional, 40 years old, at the height of his earning power, struck down in his prime. And the most imperfect? Well, in the calculus of personal injury law, a dead child is worth the least of all.
Today, the real story behind the film A Civil Action, how two of the nation's largest corporations, W.R. Grace and Beatrice Foods, stood accused of contaminating the water supply of Woburn, Massachusetts. And we'll find out why seven people were arrested at the Pentagon yesterday, throwing blood and oil. We'll speak with Bill Berrigan. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton says an attack on an Iraqi airbase yesterday was necessary. U.S. aircraft attacked a military base in northern Iraq from which missiles had been launched against them. It was the first serious military confrontation between the two sides since the four-day bombing raids over Iraq were ended last week. The incident came a day after Iraq threatened to fire on Western planes flying over a U.S.-declared no-fly zone over northern Iraq. Iraq said yesterday that it had probably shot down an aircraft, but the U.S. denied it. Four Iraqis were killed in the U.S. air attack yesterday. Meanwhile, at the Pentagon, seven people were arrested after throwing blood and oil at the building. Prosecutors say they'll seek the death penalty against two men charged with murdering an openly gay University of Wyoming student in a case that focused national attention on violence against gay men and lesbians. In separate statements filed in state district court, the Albany County attorney said he intends to seek the death penalty against 21-year-olds Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson for the murder of 21-year-old Matthew Shepard. McKinney and Henderson are accused of luring Shepard out of a Laramie bar by pretending they were gay, then robbing and pistol-whipping him and leaving the victim for dead on October 6th. Shepard was found unconscious and tied to a fence 18 hours later by a bicyclist who at first mistook his body for a scarecrow. The 105-pound Shepard died 5 days later of massive head injuries. In addition to first-degree murder, McKinney and Henderson are charged with kidnapping and aggravated robbery. Both have pleaded not guilty to all charges. Prosecutors declined to say why they sought the death penalty, but Wyoming law allows for capital punishment if a murder is, quote, especially atrocious or cruel, being unnecessarily torturous to the victim. Meanwhile, a federal judge has lifted stays of execution in Texas for two men who requested clemency, including a Canadian citizen, but the ruling does not ensure the sentences will be carried out. Attorneys for Danny Barber and Canadian Stan Folder argue that Texas clemency procedures violate rights to due process under the law. But U.S. District Judge Sam Sparks has ruled that the procedures, although, quote, extremely poor and certainly minimal, appeared to meet minimal safeguards of the U.S. Supreme Court. Barber and Folder were due for lethal injections in early December before being saved by last-minute stays. Sparks' latest decision removes a legal barrier to their executions. The parole board has recommended commutation of only one death sentence in Texas since pro-death penalty Governor George Bush took office in 1994. Stan Folder's case sparked an uproar in Canada over concerns that his rights under international law had been broken. He still has a stay of execution from the U.S. Supreme Court, which is considering that point. Just a day after returning to Phnom Penh under a no-arrest pledge from the government, a principal architect of Pol Pot's killing fields made the first-ever public apology by a top Khmer Rouge leader for the masses who died under the group's brutal rule of Cambodia in the 70s. Asked at a news conference today if he was sorry for the suffering in which an estimated 1.7 million Cambodians died, Khieu Samphan replied in English, "Yes, sorry, very sorry." Continuing in Cambodian, Q asked the people to forget the past and please be sorry for him. In past news conferences and interviews, Khmer Rouge leaders, including Khieu Samphan, have always brushed such questions aside. Last week, Khieu, who is head of state under the Khmer Rouge, defected to the government with Nguyen Che. The two Khmer Rouge leaders declined to answer further questions about whether they should face trial for genocide and crimes against humanity. There have been widespread calls internationally for such a trial. Both Khieu and Che returned to Phnom Penh after Prime Minister Hun Sen said on Sunday it might not be in Cambodia's interest to put them on trial and that it's time to forget the past. A date has been set for elections in Israel. Israelis will vote to elect a prime minister and new parliament next May 17th. This according to an elections bill passed by a parliamentary committee today. A senior United Nations official said today the wreckage of a UN plane which crashed in Angola's central highlands on Saturday has been found and there are signs of survivors. Issa Diallo, head of the UN Observer Mission Angola, said images from the area showed the crash plane did not disintegrate. Celebrate Kwanzaa, I want you to remember these principles to live by, to keep our people strong. Celebrate Kwanzaa, I want you to remember these principles to live by, to keep our people strong. Seven joyous days, many festivals, seven principles for each and every soul. Time to reunite, uplift all the rights of the African-American. Celebrate Kwanzaa, I want you to remember these principles to live by, to keep our people strong. Umoja, umoja, I want you to remember. Umoja means unity, to keep our people strong. Kuji Chaka, to keep our people strong. Ujima, Ujima, I want you to remember. And Kwanzaa began last Saturday. It goes on for 7 days until New Year's. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
The perfect victim is a white male professional, 40 years old, at the height of his earning power, struck down in his prime. And the most imperfect? Well, in the calculus of personal injury law, a dead child is worth the least of all.
A Civil Action is the name of a new movie starring John Travolta. It premiered in New York and Los Angeles on Christmas Day and is opening nationwide on January 8th. It's based on a book by writer Jonathan Haar. The film tells the story of how two of the nation's largest corporations, W.R. Grace and Beatrice Foods, stood accused of contaminating the water supply of Woburn, Massachusetts. Some 30 residents allege a range of medical disorders, including cancer. Several children died as a result of the contamination. Ultimately, a jury cleared Beatrice of the accusation, while W.R. Grace reached a settlement to pay the families $8 million. But the film, A Civil Action, is not only about Woburn, Massachusetts. It's about dozens of other communities across the country where large corporations may be contaminating the environment with devastating consequences for the residents, especially kids. According to the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, 40,000 uncontrolled hazardous waste sites nationwide have been reported to federal agencies. And from Toms River, New Jersey to Oakland, California, communities are fighting back. Joining us now to talk about the true story behind the film, A Civil Action, is Jan Schlickman. He's the maverick attorney who's portrayed by John Travolta in the movie. We're also joined by Laurie Mott, who's a senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Richard Afuro, who was one of the parents in the story, A Civil Action. It's not just a story, it's real life. And his child died as a result of contamination in Woburn, Massachusetts. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Well, let's begin with attorney Jan Schlickman. For people who haven't read the book, because the book has been a bestseller for a time now, which is really the story of how you came upon this story in Woburn, Massachusetts, of these families who had been gravely afflicted by contamination.
Yes.
Welcome to Democracy Now.
Well, thank you very, very much.
So tell us how it is that you came to take on this case of the families of Woburn, Massachusetts, against these mega transnational corporations, Beatrice Foods and W.R. Grace.
Well, in 1981, several mothers from Woburn came to my office to tell me, you know, their story, and they had really been struggling for several years previously. The families had been concerned with the high numbers of children in the community with leukemia, and it seemed to be, you know, a very unusually high number, and they had formed a group, and they needed answers to their questions. They had learned together that the water that they thought was safe was not safe, but contaminated with these industrial solvents. And the agencies had done a lot of work, but they couldn't answer their basic questions about who contaminated the water and when it was contaminated and whether the water was responsible for the children's leukemia. And so kind of in frustration, they were hoping that by coming to see a lawyer, by coming to see me, that somehow I would be able to help them get answers to their questions. And I was very touched by the story, but I didn't see how I could help them. I was a personal injury lawyer. You know, I represented people who were injured, and I sued people, you know, when I knew what the facts were. But here there were all questions and few answers. And so it's kind of through a long process, which is told very well in Jonathan's book, I got, you know, these were very determined people, and they were very inspiring. And eventually I got caught up in it. I got, I think seduced is the best word, and I got captured on every level that a human being can by their story and joined them on their journey.
The way the movie tells it, I just saw it actually a couple of hours ago. The way the movie tells it, you weren't sure whether you wanted to take it on. You thought they were talking about some small town refinery, tannery, I think it was.
Right.
But then you happened to stop and sort of check out where the pollution was coming from, and you saw that the names of some large corporations.
Right. Well, the movie does a very good job, I think, of trying to, lay out some of the seductive process. But basically, it was a process of I tried to find other lawyers to take on the case, and there's just nobody in the country would take it because no case like that had ever been done before. And like I say, these families were very determined and very inspiring. It was hard to say no to them. And then I did, as I was going through it, I did become caught up in the challenge. You know, nobody had ever done this before. And so on every level that a human being can be captured, I was, good and bad and ugly. And I got caught up in the challenge. I got caught up in the idea that, well, if I was able to do this thing, I'd be the first one to do it, that it was an important thing to do. And so on every level, I got caught up.
Richard Ofiero, as I said, is also with us. You're one of the parents in Woburn, Massachusetts, who were gravely affected by the contamination of the community. Can you tell us your story?
Well, my son became sick in 1981. And
how old was he?
He was 3 and a half. He was 3 and a half when he died. He was a little over 3 when he got sick. And one day I went to a store and I ran into one of the parents that Jim was talking about, Donna Robbins, and we started talking. I had already gotten a call from the Harvard study from the area to find out about, who's sick in the neighborhood. So I started talking to Donna. Her son happened to be sick at the same time as mine. And we got to talking and we got involved, and she put me down with Ann Anderson down to FACE, which is for a cleaner environment, which is a group they all started here. And I went down, and you wouldn't believe the amount of pins that were on this map that we had of people who were sick. Not just the children. There was many, many people who were ill in the area.
There's a very powerful scene in the movie, A Civil Action, where you're being deposed, and you tell the story of what happened to your son.
You can tell when your child isn't feeling well. You try to explain it to them on the phone, and they say, has he got a temperature? You say, no, he's all right then, they say. Don't worry, bring him into the clinic Monday morning. He died Monday morning.
He was in the clinic when he died.
No. He was in the car on the way.
He died in the car on the way to the clinic?
He died on I-93, up by the Sunland Hill exit. My wife was yelling that he had stopped breathing. I pulled over and tried to give him CPR. And I was holding him in my lap. Lauren was screaming. Cars and trucks rushing by.
This not only a scene from a new movie called A Civil Action, but the real-life story of Richard Afuero and his wife as their three-and-a-half-year-old son died. They believe as a result of contamination of the water supply of Woburn, Massachusetts. When did your son die, Richard?
September 20th of 1982. We're positive that it was the water supply. Since they closed the wells, the cases are almost nil. And my other son, who was born after the wells were closed, they used him as a control for all our testing and everything. And he's a huge, healthy young man now.
Jen Schlickman, talk about the process of the case, how you went from saying, how can we possibly prove this, to being able to prove the connection between, well, W.R. Grace and you had Beatrice Foods, though Beatrice Foods in the end was severed from the case. Is that right?
Yeah, there was a verdict that, and the judge had made several rulings and made it very hard for the jury to find them liable because he restricted the time period. But basically, our challenge was that we had to show that the two companies were responsible for the contamination. That was one front of this war, and I think war is the best metaphor for what we were up against. And the second part was to show that the exposure to these chemicals in the water actually profoundly affected the health. You know, the families responsible for the leukemias as well as other serious health problems. And basically the way we did it, it was an approach in which we researched the world's literature on these chemicals. We brought together scientists and doctors who had never been brought together before from all these different disciplines to examine the families, all of them, to look at all of their health histories from the beginning, you know, from their birth until the present, to examine how it changed over time as their residential histories changed as they came into the city, as children were born. And we looked at them neurologically, cardiologically, immunologically, all these different perspectives, and we had these people talk for the first time, scientists and doctors talk about what they saw. And it was really quite an exhilarating experience because these ended up being scientific symposia that we would have, and we would have them actually around the country as our scientists went about their work. And we were actually funding original scientific and medical research in order to be able to prove our case in court. You know, everybody said when we started the case why we'd get the Nobel Prize for medicine if we were able to prove it, because nobody had ever done that before. And so in the context of this litigation, we really did what no government agency or, a college or university or corporation had ever done. We funded this original research, and more we looked, the more we found. We found profound impact on the family's health as they've got exposed to this water and the kinds of problems that they had, from the skin rashes and gastrointestinal problems and immunologic problems to neurologic problems and cardiologic problems, which was all of a pattern which is symptomatic of being poisoned by these chemicals, similar to what workers were. And in fact, we had scientists who had done work on, you know, workers who would have been exposed to these chemicals in very high levels. And they were astounded to find that these families and the children were exhibiting the same kind of symptoms that workers were at levels that they thought were higher. And when we did further tests, we found that just living in the house, because these chemicals are volatile, was enriching the household air, and that was where the greatest exposure was, not drinking the water or using it in their food, just living in the house. And so all of these pieces all came together in a very compelling way that we wish to present to the jury.
We're talking to attorney Jen Schlickman, who represented the families of Woburn, Massachusetts, against the giants Beatrice Foods and W.R. Grace for contaminating the water supply. Richard Afuero also with us, whose son died years ago at the age of 3.5 from leukemia. He works at Harvard University. When we come back, we'll continue speaking with them, and we'll be joined by Laurie Mott of the Natural Resources Defense Council to look at how these kinds of issues are being played out around the country. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, this story now being told in a major motion picture called A Civil Action. We'll be back in a minute.
Righteousness, we must all come together for the fruits of our labor. We live all together. Pajama, cooperative economics, one and all. Make grandfather sell bacon for 50 cents. Come buy from him so we can pay our rent. My brother, he got a lemonade stand. If you buy a glass, he will feel so grand. Ooh, yeah, yeah. Pajama. Ooh, yeah, yeah. Economics. Ooh, yeah, yeah. Pajama. Cooperative economics, one and all. Miss Sister's a carpenter, she can build a house for a king or queen or even a mouse.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at the story behind A Civil Action, which is premiering in Los Angeles and New York now, it stars John Travolta. It's based on the book by Jonathan Haar by the same title. We're joined by the star of the movie, the real star, not John Travolta, attorney Jan Schlickman, as well as one of the family members that he represented in this major and precedent-setting lawsuit, Richard Alfiero, whose son died several years ago as a result of contamination of the water of Woburn, Massachusetts. Jan Schlickman, before we get on to other cases around the country, and I know you're involved with some of those cases of water contamination and how they affect communities, I wanted to ask you a question that relates very much to politics in Washington today, and that is the issue of perjury, the whole issue of perjury around President Clinton that has been made an enormous deal of. But in the case that you brought against W.R. Grace and Beatrice Foods, there is also the issue of perjury and documents that were destroyed, documents that were false. Can you talk about that and what kind of responsibility and what kind of standard W.R. Grace and Beatrice Foods was held to?
Well, I appreciate the question very much, because that was probably the part of the case, and this really occurred after the verdict and during the appeal, and lasted a 4-year period, actually, which was really, I believe, the most destructive part of the case from my perspective, because it was the most illuminating to me about the legal system and how it works or it doesn't. And when you ask the question about perjury, you know, I looked at the truth like it was a commodity, like lawyers look at it, you know, that I was told by the lawyer for Beatrice Foods that, you know, what's truth? Truth is at the bottom of a bottomless pit. And I believed that vision of the truth, that, you know, it was something that could be buried, and that it was my job to unbury it. You know, I had to go into the pit, you know, and bury and unbury this valuable commodity, and then be richly rewarded, you know, for taking the journey. And what you come to appreciate at the, you know, I uncovered thousands of pages of documents that were destroyed, evidence that had been, you know, a whole cleanup operation that had taken place secretly, and then you know, witnesses who confessed to having lied, you know, under oath on important issues of chemical dumping at the properties and the property's relationship to the pollution in the wells, all the stuff that would have helped us win the case. And what the judge did was, you know, he got really angry, as one would expect, but not at me for digging it up, not at them for burying it, but for me for digging it up. And it taught me something. What it taught me was that this concept of perjury, you know, that we're all so interested in, is really a concept that serves power. It's not really a concept that serves the truth. You know, we claim it's trying to serve the truth, but in fact, it is something that serves power and power's need to impose its will. And it was an education for me. And I was participating in that vision, which I think was a very destructive one. I've now come to realize that truth is something that's all around us. It's not something that's buried in a pit. And it comes to us. It's not something we have to go and get and destroy things in order to get, or something that's worth fighting over. It's something that comes to us, and we all, if we work together, you know, through the shared experience of discovery. And I found that in Woburn, that people would tell me things, the truth about things, not because they were in a deposition and they were under the pains and penalties of perjury, but they told me at their kitchen table, you know, when they were suffering from leukemia themselves, or saw things that they just couldn't, you know, as a human being, keep hidden anymore. And that's when the truth came out. When people wanted it to, it came out. And that was an eye-opening and enlightening thing. And when I saw how the courts dealt with perjury by powerful people, by protecting powerful people, then I realized that this concept of perjury is not serving us well, and that we have to begin to look as lawyers and as citizens at the truth as something we all have a responsibility for, we all share in, and we all have to work together towards.
Jan Schlickman, what cases are you involved with right now?
Well, I'm working on working with several communities who are living under a cloud because they woke up to find that their soils are contaminated or their drinking water is contaminated with chemicals. I'm working in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and also Toms River, New Jersey, a community just like Woburn in many ways, with wells that are contaminated, drinking wells with the same kinds of chemicals as in Woburn, 60 families whose children have cancers, a very high number, some of the highest numbers of childhood cancer in the state of New Jersey, which has some of the highest in the country, and two companies implicated, you know, in the pollution of the water. I don't know why it's always two, but there you have it.
What are those companies?
Union Carbide and Ciba Geigy, two very large companies. And we're approaching it, applying the lessons of Woburn, and using this concept of truth that I just talked to you about, which is that in Woburn we had a war, which we felt we had to fight. But in Toms River, what we did is the families organized into a group called TEACH, Toxic Environments Affect Children's Health, and they started forming partnerships with the state and local officials and with the federal government. And then we went to the companies, and we offered them a partnership as well, a partnership in which we would sit down and share information and try and talk with each other, not, you know, at each other. And the companies responded by signing an agreement that carved out an 18-month period that we're halfway through right now, in which we are sitting down on a regular basis and sharing information to see if we can, you know, figure the past out and what we should do about it. Now, it's very challenging, and it by no means, it promises that we'll all work it out in the end, but it gives us an opportunity to approach this problem in a more collaborative way that offers us hope of getting it right, rather than the waste of war. And war is a waste. You know, although necessary, it really is, you know, evil. And in Toms River, we're just trying to see if we cannot find another way to solve this problem in a way that, you know, gets us to the answer much quicker with less waste. Hmm.
Richard Alfiero, at least in the movie, if this is accurate, each of the families got something like $350,000. We're talking about families like yours that lost children, in your case, your 3.5-year-old son, this coming from an $8 million settlement with W.R. Grace. What is your reaction to that?
Well, the money was mine. It was nothing to do with really the case. We never did get our day in court. I don't know what Jane means by a war that we were fighting. I mean, we were fighting for our lives. I don't think that's a war myself. I don't think we had justice. Justice wasn't served at all in our case. We never got our chance to really get out there with the companies, and I blame the judge for that more than anything.
In your case, you had this judge that restricted a lot of the evidence, but then it sort of went to a second level beyond the settling of the lawsuit of $8 million, and that went to the EPA going after the companies, the U.S. government. Did you think it went to it in any serious way? I mean, as a result of that, what happened? The plants were forced to close?
Well, John J. Reilly was going out of business anyway, and W.R. Grace did close. It still sits there. It sits there all fenced in, just like a giant eyesore of what the past was. The EPA came in late as usual and came in with all the results, everything that we were saying right along, which, you know, to us is good in a way. We did get the area cleaned up, but it was a little bit too little too late for us.
Why didn't they come before?
It's the government. I mean, if the people of John J. Reilly shut down their wells, and the city of Woburn shut the wells down when they knew the water was bad, my son would still be alive. He was the last one to get sick. He was the last one to die.
Lori Mott, you certainly know this story well, and it's one that you have seen repeated a lot. Lori Mott is senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and she directs the Children's Environmental Health Initiative in San Francisco. Can you talk about the kind of effects that these toxics have and on children's health?
Well, the toxics involved in Woburn have now been shown, several of the industrial solvents have now been shown without a doubt to be linked to cancer. They're also linked to neurological harm, so they can affect the ability of children to learn properly in school. And they've also been linked to birth defects. But the chemicals that our children in this country are exposed to are not limited, regrettably, to those that are involved in Woburn. I mean, daily our children are exposed to air pollution, they're exposed to pesticides in their food, they're exposed to contaminants in their drinking water. And the science clearly shows that children are more vulnerable to these chemicals than adults are. Their bodies are still growing and developing. Their defense mechanisms are not fully operational in the early years of life. And their brains and you know, neurological systems are still developing, continue to develop till puberty. So they're very vulnerable to all these chemicals that they are exposed to.
And what impact does these kind of chemicals, and maybe you could name some of them, have on reproductive health?
On reproductive health, for example, TCE, which is one of the solvents that was found in the drinking water in Woburn and has been found in drinking water elsewhere in the country, has been linked to congenital heart defects in children born of women exposed to drinking water containing these contaminants. And I think there's a very fundamental point here that we need to think about, which is that this is a terrible tragedy that should never be repeated. And regrettably, it is happening every day all across the country. Many of these chemicals are clearly known to be health hazards. We have a system of federal and state laws that is supposed to be protecting all of us, including our children, and it is not working. The fact that the community of Woburn had to go through what it did is a very pointing sign of the failure of the federal system. And I think that if there is a lesson that we can take home, we must tell our politicians, whether they're going to listen or not, whether they're going to do the right thing is almost beside the point. As citizens, we must tell them that we want them to fully enforce the environmental laws that have been on the books for nearly three decades to protect all of us, but especially to protect the next generation.
Lori Mott with the Natural Resources Defense Council, joining Richard Alfiero of Woburn, Massachusetts, and attorney Jan Schlickman. How do you hold corporations responsible? You do it on a case-by-case basis. I mean, we hear Jan Schlickman going from W.R. Grace and Beatrice Foods now to Ciba Geigy and you said Union Carbide?
Yes. Well, I'll tell you how you do it. What I tell you, what Woburn, what I've learned as a lawyer now who have tried to, you know, who has represented several communities now faced with these problems is the thing that I have learned is the transforming power of the truth, that the only power that communities really have in the end, you know, they don't have the what we normally think of as power, but the power that they do have, which is really quite considerable, comes from the truth itself. And it is the revealing of the truth which does get power, you know, to change its behavior. And that's the only thing they really have in the end. And so what I've come to appreciate is that you have to figure out ways to get the truth out, you know, to have a truth that people, you know, can't ignore. And so it's every time a community has stood up for itself, has organized itself, and then has taken the responsibility for working with others to get the truth revealed, it has tremendous power. They get tremendous power that way, and they get power to... they get companies to change behavior, they get government regulators to take action. That's the only way that I know that works. There's nothing else that they, there's no, thing that a community can go, they can't go into a courtroom and demand justice and then expect a, you know, a judge to rule in their favor unless they have done this other thing, which is the showing that they're right.
You know,
and showing that they're right in a way that people can't deny. That's the only thing that they can do in order to get the respect of power.
For people who read the book of Civil Action or see the movie that's now just out, Civil Action, They might say, if they're lawyers, for example, that this is certainly not worth the price. I mean, your law firm split up in the end. You were completely destroyed. This is not to mention the pain of the families, which in the end doesn't compare to the pain of the loss of family members in a family. But it seems that the biggest lesson is that you just cannot do it alone. An individual crusading lawyer is not enough, that there has to be consortiums set up around the country of communities and legal experts, community activists.
Yes, absolutely. This is, you know, this is the lesson that I learned. We cannot do it on our own. We cannot do it alone. And I thought that's how, you know, that was my job. And, you know, as valiant as we were, and we were, you know, as courageous as the families were, and they were beyond all measure, we could not do it by ourselves. You know, we were out there, you know, hoping that others would follow. And what we have, you know, what we learned is that we must bring them along with us. You know, we must form these alliances, because what will happen is that power in the end, you know, will see this as a threat and it will squash it, you know, like so much, you know, like a bug. And we cannot allow that to happen. That's what I've learned. And so I was playing into their, you know, by following this process, you know, I was allowing us to be defeated, really, in the end. And I've come to learn that we have to approach it in a different way, where people cannot deny the reality of the past, no matter how ugly it is. It must be revealed in a way that cannot be ignored, and then behavior will change, and then justice will be done.
Richard,
that's the only way.
Richard Ofiero, what about how you organized in Woburn? Because you have this issue. On the one hand, you have the families of sick kids. You have the parents of sick kids and kids who die. On the other hand, a lot of people in the community, in your case, Woburn, Massachusetts, who work for the companies. And you have that, you know, standard sort of fault line between the two. How did you cross that divide?
No, it was very difficult to cross that. Some of the some of the people in the movement besides us got involved and helped out. That's what I was telling you about, Face for a Cleaner Environment. It started here. They got involved and helped us find the people and everything. But to get people from the companies to cross over, especially Beatrice, which was called John J. Riley, that was impossible. He had threatened his workers. I had worked with a few of them. They were retired from his place. They threatened to take away their pensions. And we lucked out with one young gentleman from Grace, who's in the movie also, Al Love. I mean, he did cross over. I'm not sure if it happened the way it did, but in the movie. But Al, his daughter babysat my son. He was a neighbor of mine and Ann's. And he crossed over, and he helped us immensely, but that was it. Right. Everybody else lied right along. Right. And people that I knew, I worked at W.R. Grace long before the wells of this happened, but I knew some of those people, and they lied right along.
And that story, I think, is very instructive. The one that Richard just talked about is that Al Love lived in the neighborhood, and it was because of Al Love's, you know, basic, his heart and his conscience and his own desire to protect his own family safety that got him to take that courageous step to walk literally across the street to sit down and talk with Ann and tell her what he knew. You know, I had been deposing him under the pains and penalties of perjury, and that was not enough. It was, you know, he had to make the decision as a human being, you know, to stand up for himself, for his family, and his community. And when he did that, then I was able to pry, you know, loose others, you know, with him. It was a slow, you know, process. But
Jen,
that's how it happened.
Jen Schlickman, were any of these people jailed for perjury? Were any of them convicted of perjury, both in your deposing of them, in the companies, the people who worked for the companies?
No, nobody. Nobody suffered any.
Even though it was proven?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Did they lie?
Proven, but the judge found that, in fact, Riley had deliberately withheld information. Riley was the owner of the tannery for Beatrice Foods, that their attorneys had been involved. I mean, all of these things were found, that thousands of pages of documents had been withheld and all of the cleanup operation, all these things had occurred. It was all found and disclosed and admitted to by some of the attorneys for Beatrice, but nothing was done. In fact, what they said was that they punished us. They punished me, the families, by saying that you had your case without your best evidence, and so we're going to punish you by not punishing them for bringing your case without the best evidence that they withheld from you. Is that kind of Orwellian doublethink?
Well, finally, because we do have to go, the effect of both the movie and the book, which is a bestseller before the movie, now just coming out, it'll be released all over on January 8th. How are you using this? I mean, you've got John Travolta, you've got big names, you've got a blockbuster movie going.
Well, we're really fortunate. Environmental Media Services have started a national campaign working with environmental groups and citizens groups all around the country. They have a website, if I can give it, www.acivilactive.com, acivilactive.com. And in there, you'll be able to be plugged in with all sorts of interesting folks, activists, and people all around the country who are interested in this issue with a lot of information. And that's what we're trying to do, trying to use this as an opportunity to get people to be entertained, and in that entertainment process, hopefully enlightened that this is something that really is about life itself and about the future of our community.
I want to thank you all very much for being with us. I have the media packet for Civil Active, a project of Environmental Media Services, and it talks about toxic hotspots around the country, from Storrs, Connecticut, University of Connecticut failing to close a toxic landfill, to Oakland, California, a medical waste incinerator spewing dioxin, mercury, and heavy metals, to East Liverpool, Ohio, one of the world's largest toxic waste incinerators standing right next to an elementary school, Lake Charles, Louisiana, the Hudson River, and on and on and on to Maryland, Wagner's Point as well. And again, if people want to get hold of that on the web, www.civilactive.com, the movie coming to movie theaters all over the country. It's called A Civil Action. Our guests have been attorney Jan Schlickman, who is the person whom A Civil Action is based. And the book is also based, of course, on the families of those who died in Woburn, Massachusetts. Richard Alfiero with us, the father of one of those young people who was 3 and a half baby when he died. Also, Lori Mott, senior scientist, Natural Resources Defense Council. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're going to continue to talk about citizen action and community action when we come back. We're going to go to find out what happened at the Pentagon yesterday and what's happening in Minnesota, why the largest police action took place there this past weekend. Stay with us.
ਜਾਣਾ ਪਈਆ ਤੇਰੇ ਬਿਨਾ ਤੂੰ ਗਰਿਆ ਬੋਲਣਾ ਸ਼ਮਾ ਪਈਆ ਤੇਰੇ ਬਿਨਾ ਤੂੰ ਗਰਿਆ ਡੋਲਣਾ ਰੋ ਰੋ ਕੇ ਮੈਂ ਦੇਵਾਂ ਸਦਾ ਤੂੰ ਗਰਿਆ ਡੋਲਣਾ ਸ਼ਮਾ ਪਈਆ tere bina tu garya dolna
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we reported at the top of the show, U.S. aircraft have struck in Iraq. They struck an Iraqi airbase there, killing 4 Iraqis. And at the same time that that was going on, yesterday 7 people were arrested at the Pentagon as they threw blood and oil on a new tunnel that just opened there. Today, the protesters are headed to the White House. And we're joined right now by Bill Frankelstraight, who is part of the Catholic Worker Movement and was one of the people who were protesting at the Pentagon. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bill.
Good morning, Amy.
Good to be with you. Tell us what happened yesterday.
Yesterday, early in the morning, when most of the workers at the Pentagon arrived, a number of us, actually a group of 100 demonstrators and a lot of children, families, from different Catholic worker houses and resistance communities around, especially the east coast of the country here, we gathered at the Pentagon, and myself and others, as you mentioned, using blood and red dye and oil, marked actually the pavement and part of the wall of a new entrance that was opened up at the Pentagon leading into the tunnel entrance, which is, if you're familiar with the Pentagon, it's one of the most used entrances for workers. And as we poured the blood and oil, we had banners in the background articulating what we were there for. and that is that this building is responsible for massacres around the world. And you know, when we say that the Pentagon and the United States is the greatest purveyor of war in history, we really mean that, and I think it's true. The facts would bear that out. So we're remembering the massacre of the innocents, both in the Christian story in the Bible, which those stories form us and inform us, and also the massacre of Wounded Knee, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and most notably in Iraq. I was in Iraq in September myself on a delegation and saw the massacre of the children 5 years old and younger. And the Bible is 2 years old or younger. And so it was a matter of going to the Pentagon to bring the consequences of what they do in that building to their doorstep, and literally they had to walk through the blood and oil that we had poured there. And even if that blood and oil we didn't pour it there, it's our contention that it's always there. People are dealing with blood. War is a bloody business.
And explain the oil, Bill Frankenstreich.
Well, the oil, for sure, since Iraq is the big bull, the big enemy now for the United States, and I think most reasonable people would realize that the sole reason we're involved in the Gulf and in the continuing containment of Iraq is to control the oil resources there. That's what I believe the end product of the sanctions are all about, is to keep Iraq down with more or less a boot on their neck so that they cannot rival us in the resources of oil that are available in the Gulf.
Bill Frankenstreich, you have a long history in the peace movement, really putting your body on the line, and it's, I think, very relevant in this holiday season, a time people might forget is a spiritual time amidst all the commercialism. But could you just briefly tell us, I don't know if it was the first time that you went to jail, but one of the actions that you were involved with that led to maybe your longest jailing?
And actually, it was back in 1991, New Year's morning. And that, if you remember, was the 15 days before the deadline, literally deadline for the Gulf. And myself and the woman who became my wife, we cut through three fences and entered a SAC Air Force Base, Griffiths Air Force Base, up in Rome, New York, and began the symbolic and real disarmament of a B-52 bomber. We found out later on in court, when we were put on trial, that that bomber was grounded for 6 weeks, which was a duration of the air war. So to our mind and knowledge, it's the only warplane that was scheduled to go to Iraq that did not. So that's why we say it's real in the sense that it was literally grounded and was not able to bomb, but also symbolic to say that this is what people of conscience and faith could do. And what does the massacre of the innocents throughout the world call us to do? And now that I have children, I have three small children, 5 years old, 4, and a one-year-old, it's that much more necessary to act, to not only protect my own children, but to realize that there's children throughout the world that are as old as my children that are in danger of being massacred by the U.S. war machine.
Bill Frankenstreich is our guest. I should say at the top of the show, I said we were going to be talking to Phil Berrigan, who just got out of jail. We're not able to speak to him now, but he, too, a part of the Plowshares movement, where people like Bill and Philip Berrigan and others put their own bodies on the line and hammer on warheads and end up going to jail for long periods of time. Do you think it's worth it?
I guess it's following one's conscience and living humanly is rewarding of itself. Obviously, there's no monetary reward, and nobody's pinning medals on us. We just feel it's what's required of us to be genuine human beings. We have such a skewed view of what it means to be human in this culture that accepts weapons of mass destruction, our own weapons of mass destruction, as necessary and a part of life.
What are you doing today at the White House?
At the White House, we'll probably have a presence outside. It's still in the process of planning. This is a very organic and communal group that's here, and we create as we go along, listening to our conscience, praying, and analyzing. And we'll probably be out front of the White House as we usually do, and bringing banners and song and prayer. And what we've been doing lately is bringing pictures of Iraqi children. A number of us have been involved in the wilderness delegations and have brought back what the sanctions are, the face of the sanctions. And we need people to see that because they're not seeing it anywhere else.
Bill Frankenstraat, do you have a number people can call to get involved with the Plowshares movement, to get in contact with the Catholic Worker?
Yes, you could call Dorothy Dayhouse here in Washington, D.C. at 202-882-9649.
That's 202-882-9649. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you for all you do, Amy. It's a great program that you have, to informing people that we're not getting in the mainstream press.
Well, I thank you for being one of those voices that gets out around the country. And thanks to Internet, we're able to get it out around the world. So thank you very much. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And, you know, as you listen to grassroots activists around the country, think about what you think has been the most important issues, or the issues you thought were worth standing up for over the last year. We would love to hear from you and play some of your comments on our end-of-the-year wrap-up. We'll be doing two. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about issues at the end of the year. And on Thursday, we'll be bringing you what's become a tradition now on Democracy Now!, and that is Peter Beauchesne's Shortcut Through 1998.
What will you remember about 1998?
Evil was very strong in those days.
The A's are 228, the A's are 206. Article 1 is adopted.
Ah, you run rascal.
Article 1 is adopted.
One of them got a PC, huh?
Look at this, Bobby.
What do I think of 1998? Is that the question?
Ask him if he's living with her. Why does he give me his telephone number?
I say that you have the power to terminate that damage and heal the wounds that you have created.
Ask him, why does he come over? He's the one you need to be asking those questions, not me.
He sure may resign your post. To stop destroying imperfect people.
What are we gonna do, Bob? Tune in for a shortcut through 1998.
You feeling that responsibility?
You've tried hard as you can. They'll home here a while, then adjust.
Well, we're safe for now. Thank goodness we're in a bowling alley.
Cut transmission!
Cut transmission?
Cut it!
That's Thursday on Democracy Now! On New Year's Eve. But tomorrow we're going to be playing your comments on what you think were the most important issues of the year, what inspired you, what devastated you. Give us a call. You can email us or call us, and we'll play and read some of those comments. Our phone number, 212-209-2999. That's 209-2999, area code 212. You can email us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org.
Protesters, we have our hands up. We have our hands up.
We're peaceful protesters.
No, you're not listening to another excerpt of a movie. This was real life on December 20th, when hundreds of police officers moved in on a group of protesters in Minneapolis and what became the biggest law enforcement action in Minnesota history. Hundreds of police officers moving in, sniper squads moving in with tear gas, arresting 37 people. Yesterday, 25 of those people were arraigned in Minneapolis on various charges ranging from trespassing to resisting arrest. They're part of a larger movement that's resisting the redirection of a state highway to the largest mall in the United States called the Mall of America. The proposed rerouting would take the road through sacred land and one of the last remaining wild areas in the Twin Cities. We're joined now by the man who made that phone call to us, Solstice, one of dozens of people who were occupying a row of houses in southern Minneapolis, which they call Minnehaha Free State, when the police moved in. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Solstice.
Good morning, Amy.
So tell us why the occupation has gone on now for, what, 4.5 months where you have been squatting or occupying this area?
Yeah, we came in on August 10th and declared the Free State. And it's actually been a 40-year struggle through the legal process to stop this road, which is immensely unpopular in the community. Everybody is against this road except the bureaucrats. And after all legal means were exhausted, Earth First was asked to join the struggle, and we set up these lockdown sites where we locked down to different houses. That's where I was when I made that phone call on December 20th at 4 a.m. in the morning. And we came in and used our direct action ways. We also came in with the Mendota, Metawakaton, Dakota, who this land is sacred to, and various other individuals. So that's why it's gone on. And we're back at the site now after the raid, even though they demolished all the houses, 7 houses within within hours of the raid. We're back and we're squatting again.
What do these houses have to do with the road? Are they where the road will be?
Yeah, the 7 houses were in the way of where the road is planned to go through. And there was a couple, Carol and Al Kratz, who are in their late 60s. Al has Alzheimer's, and they've been fighting it, and they're the ones who invited Earth First and the Mendota, Metawakaton, Dakota, and the American Indian Movement to join, along with Stop the Reroute, to come to these houses. To squat these houses.
Tell us what Attorney General Janet Reno now has to do with the rerouting of this road to the largest mall in the United States.
Well, she sent in Jesse Taylor from the Justice Department, the Midwest Director of the Justice Department, to try to meet with MnDOT officials and to meet with us and to try to find out what was going on. There was an article in the Star Tribune which basically said that MnDOT was pretty unreasonable and kind of refused to meet with him because they're in violation of several federal laws, including Federal Highway Code Section 4F303, which states that they can't go through sacred land, historic sites, residential areas, or parkland if there is a feasible alternative, which there is. So basically they kind of ignored him, and 1 week later they came and raided us, partially because, in my estimation, they might fear that on a federal level this project could be stopped because it is in violation of several federal laws.
Solstice, how old are you?
I'm 20 years old.
Uh-huh. How did you get involved with this?
I've been involved with Earth First for a while, and I came in at the request of Earth First. Some of my friends called me and told me about this project, so I came in at the very beginning.
So what is your ultimate goal now after 4.5 months? What are your plans as we move into the new year?
Well, we still plan to stop this road. The road is immensely unpopular. The display of brutality by the police when they came in, it even contributes even more to our cause. It's made people even more sympathetic. We're organizing a speak out. People are outraged that 600 police came in from the National Guard. That's where they moved in from. They're probably trained. It was a military operation. Came in, tortured people when they were already in handcuffs. And so we plan to stop this road. We plan to expose further the brutality because the press was barred. Most people don't know what happened yet because the press was barred from the scene.
By the police?
By the police, mm-hmm. That's right. In fact, one press corps person was arrested because he didn't have a red dot on his card.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Solstice, for joining us, updating us on the situation that we have been covering now for a while. Solstice joining us from Minneapolis. That does it for today's program. Again, I want to give out that phone number for you to share what you felt are the most significant events of 1998. Our phone number is 212-209-2999. Leave your name, where you're calling from, and your thoughts at this end of the year. You can also send us email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mario Murillo and Max Pringle, also Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland's our technical director, thanks to Robert Knight. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. Michelle Garcia is our web spinner. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science, as well as issues concerning war, peace, and the environment. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science and politics, including the aftermath of Operation Desert Fox. I think most military analysts would say it was a tactical victory, with our smart bombs scoring an 85% hit rate. However, strategically, I think most analysts have now declared it to be a failure. In other words, the United States may have won the battle, only to lose the larger war. Second of all, the U.S. Department of Energy now wants to convert 3 commercial nuclear power plants operated by the Tennessee Valley Authority to make bomb material. That's right, converting commercial nuclear power plants to make weapons-grade fuel for our hydrogen bomb arsenal. This is important because it marks for the very first time that the Department of Energy has admitted the obvious, that commercial nuclear power plants can in fact be used to make bomb material. This now officially ends the charade of the last 40 years of the Atoms for Peace program. Third, the Food and Drug Administration has now approved a new vaccine for Lyme disease. The vaccine has been tested among about 11,000 people. It has scored a 78% success rate after three doses of the vaccine. However, I think there's a larger issue here, because the whole reason why we even have a problem with Lyme disease is because of suburban development that went into previously forested regions. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. Once again, she's Sandra Blakesley, and she's been a science reporter for the New York Times for the past 30 years. And she's the main contributor to a new book called Science Times and the Brain. Last week, we aired part one of this fascinating interview when we talked about why the brain sleeps and what is known about the physiology of dreaming. This week, we're going to talk about neurotransmitters, dopamine, drug addiction, mental illness, how the brain memorizes, and the whole question of consciousness. So once again, our special guest today is going to be an authority on the human brain. And then in the second half of exploration, we're going to take listener phone calls. Specifically, we're going to continue a dialogue that we had with a college in Los Angeles whose class emailed me a bunch of questions concerning the 21st century. Well, let's begin. Operation Desert Fox seems to be, at least on the surface, a resounding success. It turns out that 85% of the targets that were designated were in fact hit, 75% of them were destroyed. 300 aircraft flew 600 missions in Operation Desert Fox over a period of 4 days, 300 cruise missiles at a cost of about $1 million per cruise missile was launched. And if you compare this with Operation Desert Storm, you see some rather striking differences. First of all, even though during Operation Desert Storm on CNN television, we were dazzled by images of smart bombs going right through the doorway of enemy barracks, it now turns out that most of those footage was, in fact, Pentagon propaganda. The Pentagon very cleverly did not show you photographs of cruise missiles going haywire, going berserk, slamming into things like hospitals and what have you. And instead, we now know that the bulk of the damage done to Iraq during Operation Desert Storm of 1991 was caused by B-52 bombers pounding the desert from the air. In other words, B-52 were dropping dumb bombs. Dumb bombs, not smart bombs, did most of the work. And in fact, the success rate of smart bombs has, in fact, been disputed ever since. One admiral said that the only thing you can count on for a smart weapon to do is to hit the ground. Other than that, the success rate of smart bombs has been very much challenged by military analysts. Specifically, the Patriot missile. Even Israeli intelligence analyzing frame by frame scenes of the Patriot missile hitting Scud missiles in the air have now declared that not a single